Today on An Incomplete History, we'll be discussing several rebellions you may or may not have heard of. You might have heard of the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion back in middle school or high school, but how much do you really know about them? Do you know that these two events fundamentally changed the way the nation was organized? The Constitution, George Washington's first president, none of these things may have happened without Shays Rebellion and then the Whiskey Rebellion. Hello and welcome to An Incomplete History.
I'm Hillary.
And I'm Jeff.
We're your hosts for this weekly history podcast.
So, good evening, Hillary.
Yeah, it's nighttime.
It's nighttime. We're recording at nighttime. It was a busy week. You had a busy day today.
I did. My parents are visiting from California. And so I'm in Oxford, Mississippi, and so that's like northern Mississippi. It's about an hour and a half away from Memphis. So we went up to Memphis for the day, and we went to Graceland, the Elvis Presley house and museum, and it was insanely expensive and kind of a trip, but it was good. And then we had some barbecue, and then we went to the largest Bass Pro Shops in the United States along the Mississippi River. And that's what
I did
today. Nothing. Just went to look at it because I kept
asking. You didn't buy a single thing?
I bought some circus peanuts for my dad for the drive home because he wanted to eat circus peanuts.
Such a random purchase in a Bass Pro Shop.
Well, because they have like these old candies there. And he saw those. Was like, oh, I haven't had those in years. And so I was like, cool. Well, we'll get them for the ride home. So,
I mean, nothing for Davi and Jenny?
No, but I did see some stuff that I was interested in purchasing. I'm not going to lie. There was a lot of camouflage, and I felt like...
But you've been having issues with them getting lost in the woods lately.
That's true. So
I don't know if you need to put camo on them.
That's true.
So...
Anyway. Well, now we're here together to talk about these rebellions. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It is hot as the blazes in Southern California. We're under a red flag warning. I didn't know whether the university was going to be closed down today because they turned the power off to prevent a fire. Who knows?
Like, I'm glad you're able to do this podcast with your electricity going in and out.
Yes. It's for those listeners who aren't aware, Southern California, our hottest time of the year is right now. A lot of my freshmen who are from other parts of the country are asking me, they're like, I didn't think it was supposed to get hot like this in San Diego. And I was like, oh, well, October and early November can be pretty warm.
Yeah, I remember my sophomore year of high school, the entire week of Halloween, the school was closed because that was during the 2003, the witch fire, I believe it was called. Mm-hmm. And the entire week the school was closed and we didn't get to go in costume to school and everyone was really upset about it. But it was very Halloween-y because it was raining ash.
So. Right. Well, so today we're talking about rebellions. We're talking about two rebellions in particular. How much did you know about these when you were in high school?
I mean,
the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we covered them in AP US history, but it was cursory. And, you know, I think the reason why these rebellions never stuck with me and why they maybe don't stick with people is because they're covered in such a perfunctory way. Like, will this happen? And I never felt like anybody tied it to something larger. And I'm excited for us to talk about this right now to really kind of delve into how important these moments were in the early moments of the United States. And it's not just a paragraph in your history book. I mean, it's so important to understanding the early republic. And I think that it just got glossed over. Did you feel that way in high school or?
It did. I mean, the Whiskey Rebellion, I think, is covered a little bit more. I mean, at least when I first took U.S. history. I mean, I think what's really interesting about it is they kind of bookend the Constitution, right?
Yeah. The start for Shays and, yeah, the end for whiskey.
And I think that in itself makes them kind of important. But as we kind of get into some details today, I think hopefully the listeners will kind of see why historians might view these as really formative moments in the early Republic. So let's jump right into Shays Rebellion. Okay. So Shays Rebellion, there's this great book that came out in the early 2000s by this historian named Leonard Richards. It's called Shays Rebellion. It came out 2003, I think. And he actually, the subtitle is it, he calls it the Final Battle of the Revolution. And I think that's important because what he gets to is what is the U.S. Revolution actually about? And his argument in the book, which is pretty short and pretty readable for non-historians, the general public, as well as useful for historians, is this idea that the revolution has multiple interpretations by people engaged in it when it's actually happening. And when it's over, people have to kind of figure out, what did this really mean? And in history, you've got kind of famous early American and Revolutionary era historians like Gordon Wood and Bernard Bailyn, who kind of argue about this, right? Is the revolution fundamentally this kind of progressive moment? Is it truly a revolution, or is it largely a conservative movement? And it's funny because I think Richard's analysis of Shays Rebellion really leads us to conclude that it was a fairly conservative change of government, right?
Yeah, I think that that's fair to say.
So Shays Rebellion happens late summer 1786 through early summer or late spring of 1787. And it emerges in Western Massachusetts. And after the revolution, a lot of people owed money. A lot of people owed money, a lot of states owed money, a lot of cities owed money, a lot of people owed money. And these people who live out in Western Massachusetts, particularly when the Massachusetts state government starts to try to collect taxes, don't have anything to pay with. And they want some kind of debt relief is really what they want. And a lot of them had fought in the revolution, and a lot of them make the argument that we fought in the revolution, we were never really properly paid for that. Can you just relieve our debt? Because we can't pay these taxes. And the Massachusetts authorities kind of say, nope, you have to, these are legitimate debts. You have to pay these. And it starts off with several people kind of marching on this courthouse, and he kind of grows. And the largest force ends up being about 4,000 or so total across Massachusetts. Some historians have said maybe about 1,500 or so at any one place. But they kind of march and they shut the courts down in Massachusetts for some time. And eventually the state says enough's enough. They call out the militia. Eventually they appeal to the federal government. Although, should we call it the federal government at this point? I don't know.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that yet. Consolidated.
I would say the Confederate government.
Yeah.
Right. And we're not talking about the Confederacy during the Civil War. We're talking about the nation is constituted under the Articles of Confederation. And they actually appeal to the U.S. military to come help with this. And, you know, the military comes in, and there's no question of who's going to win this conflict. The army or these kind of protesters who've gathered together. But what's really interesting is this thing of the protesters, according to their interpretation of the revolution, have a legitimate gripe. The government is wrestling with how do you deal with state debt that's accumulated during the war. They look at people on the coast kind of coastal merchants and say, look, they're making money. They've recovered from the war. We're still suffering out here in Western Massachusetts. And for them, it seems like these people on the coast, and I would use the term coastal elites, that's really who what they view them as, are deaf to the needs of people out in Western Massachusetts.
Well, and the people, I think what's important here too, though, is the people in Western Massachusetts, the person who the rebellion's named for, Daniel Shays, I mean, him and many others who were in debt shutting down the courts fought during the revolution.
Right.
Daniel Shays was a part of the Continental Army. He fought at the Battle of Bunker Hill. He fought at the Battle of Lexington. He fought at the Battle of Saratoga. And they weren't paid. And so they had just come off of a terribly bloody and violent conflict for which they were not compensated properly. They're in massive debt. And then they feel this newly consolidated government, still shaky, not quite federal government, but like you said, under the Articles of Confederation, they're coming after them for money, and they feel like they hadn't been compensated properly in the first place. Is that fair to say?
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's definitely, it's Shays and his followers view this as them discontinuing kind of the process of the revolution, continuing what the revolution did, which was the revolution was meant to kind of dispense with distant governments that didn't really take into account what the people needed. The early state constitution, well, they're not constitutions, the early state guiding documents created during the American Revolution really embrace this. They expand who's allowed to participate in government. A lot of them have no land owning requirement, which is truly revolutionary, right? This idea that you don't even need to know, you don't even need to own land to participate in the government. And Shays' Rebellion happens. And what's so important about it is what happens in its wake. Richards and other historians argue, we don't have the Constitution in its present form. And even more so, we don't get kind of these very conservative state constitutions without Shays' Rebellion. So a lot of states put land requirements back into requirements to vote and participate in government.
There is this argument that starts to surface very early on of who feels included and not included in government. And that's also predicated on why they fought in the revolution in the first place.
Right.
They didn't feel represented, right? And so it's like, they're not represented by the government they were fighting against. And now they're feeling like they're not being represented properly. And they don't really want to be represented by a federal government, right? And this is where the conflict, the core conflict in this country, which starts at this moment and persists, is we want to be left alone.
Right.
We don't want you bothering us. We're moving to these other areas.
I don't know.
No.
Kind of. They do, but do they really? Because they also want the government to forgive the.
So they're in this financial situation when they return from war. And
right.
They do want the debt forgiven by the government, but I don't think that they feel that it's proper to even have the debt levied at them in the first place.
Right.
Because there's this government that's forming that I think they don't. They're not fully in support of in many ways, but
right.
That well, I mean, may be unfair.
Well, I mean, I think a deeper issue, a deeper anxiety that gets revealed during Shays' Rebellion is this thing about how society was organized and deference, right?
Yes.
So deference was this idea that you were supposed to kind of defer to people who were higher than you socially, politically, whatever. And that meant just show them respect. You know, and the inverse of that, which I think is really interesting, was called condescending. And it's not our modern take on condescending. It means condescending, you know, oh, so-and-so, the state legislature, condescended to talk to me. it wasn't that it's not kind of a swarmy response. It's that it's this idea that, you know, differences between classes is very real. And if you are not kind of an elite, a ruling elite, you have to kind of wait till they speak to you before you can speak to them and these things. And deference really gets called into question during the war itself, because the rebellion or the revolution seems to be an assault on deference. And I think that's where a lot of the people who support going after Shays and all these other protesters come down. So Sam Adams, staunch revolutionary during the war, right?
Yeah.
Plus maker of fine beer. I don't know.
Could be.
I mean, he says that Shays and the other rebels should be strung up and blood should be shed. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's like, kill them. That's what he says. Yeah, he's like, we've got to kill them. Yeah. And even George Washington says that these are anything but virtuous yeomen.
Right. I mean, because when they're rebelling against Britain, it's cool. But now that they're trying to create, right, you need them. Now they're trying to create their own government. Like, whoa, 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 easy, peasants. I mean, that's kind of and that's what you're talking about with the elite situation and this idea of deference. Is like, you stay in your place when you must. And in this situation, things are shaky and they need people falling in line with the new regime. Sort of misstep, anything outside of that line, is a major threat to this really fragile state that the country finds itself in at this moment. It's fragile, and I think someone like Sam Adams, who, yeah, he's this revolutionary for a while, I mean, he also sees the importance of consolidating the Republic and falling into line in order to maintain stability and peace and allow
commerce.
For the formation of government.
And commerce.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, this is... What founding father do you think supports the Shaysites?
Well, I mean, I think that this is really nascent, maybe Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, yeah. He's in Paris at the time. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, you have to. This is where he famously says, look, you know, you got to water the tree of liberty with some blood every once in a while.
Yeah. And this is where these, the Democratic Republican societies that start to form in the 1790s, particularly in the wake of the Whiskey Rebellion, they come out at this moment also of and it's the Federalists versus Anti-Federalists. That's where.
Do you know what the Anti-Federalists are called sometimes? Shaysites,
yeah.
They're associated with this rebellion.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where you start to see. So it's confusing because they're called so many different things. But the Democratic Republican societies, the Anti-Federalists, the Shaysites, they're all a part of this more periphery, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, anti-federal government, kind of nascent political party that develops in the 1790s. And it's all kind of opposition forces. And they're all in opposition to the government that's formed, right? So it's Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, the fiscal policies that are developed. It's in opposition and speaking out against this
this
formation of strong central federal government.
Right. Well, I think where we're going to get when we switch now to kind of talking about the Whiskey Rebellion, before we get to that, is this idea that Shays Rebellion reveals this divide and a distrust between poor rural farmers and wealthy urbanized Bostonians, right?
Yes. And this is a problem that plagues the United States from this moment forward.
The rural-urban divide.
Yes. Yes. The core versus the periphery.
Right. And it's this idea that, I mean, for Shaysites, for people who follow Shays and kind of support what he's doing, they say that Washington is nothing, that Washington kind of becomes nothing but the strong arm of coastal merchants. That this is coastal merchants who held a lot of the debts owed by these men. And Washington seems to be nothing but the strong arm of this elite. And some of them say, look, you've just changed what was a British aristocracy with Parliament to something else, but to us it seems the same.
And it was to many of them, because as a matter of fact, taxes went up for a lot of these folks.
Yeah.
And well, they were even
turns out it's expensive to be on your own.
It is expensive. And they're not only in debt, but they're being heavily taxed. And they're also not represented in government because there's not any sort of universal male suffrage at this point.
But it's easier before the rebellion for them to maybe be represented. I mean, don't you think there's the irony there that the rebellion actually makes universal white male suffrage not a thing for a while?
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's because of it, right?
I mean, that's the thing is, the thing that they kind of feared would happen happens because of how they react.
As a punishment.
Oh, yeah. It's completely a punishment. To say, so you end up with these oil.
Govern.
Right. So I'll end with Shays with the loyalty oaths. So they're kind of required to sign these loyalty oaths, saying, oh, we should never have done this. And this is what this is kind of the great source he uses to construct this, is he goes back through these loyalty oaths. But it's, you know, one of the first conflicts, armed conflicts, the new nation fights after independence is an internal conflict.
Many of the things that they fight are internal conflicts. And this is just the start of it.
Right. So let's move to the whiskey rebellion. So that's kind of like when you want a type of whiskey and they don't have it.
And then you just flip out. And you
rebel. Yeah, you just flip out.
Yeah, there's a whiskey shortage. So the whiskey rebellion, it really is a great segue, because what you're talking about with the elite versus, you know, the urban-rural divide, I mean, it really comes to a head during this moment. And it is in the wake of the Constitution, right? So we're not under the Articles of Confederation anymore. The federal government has been consolidated. Alexander Hamilton creates fiscal policy because, as you said, again, this is a great segue, it's expensive to be on your own. And so how is the federal government going to be consolidated? How are they going to pay to be on their own? And they start levying taxes. And Congress approves in 1791, there's this vote that sharply divides the country. Congress approves an excise tax on distilled liquor. And it's a part of Secretary Hamilton's fiscal plan. It's important to remember that there's not paper money still at this time. I mean, it's, you know, money is in its really nascent form.
And most of the colonists, even before a revolution, most of the colonists weren't used to dealing with currency, were they?
No, it's a barter system still.
Right.
I mean, we're starting to move away from that a little bit at this time, but it's still a barter system, and whiskey is used as a barter, and it's an item for sale in these cash poor regions. So taxing whiskey interferes with some of the most mundane exchanges you would see between ordinary farmers. As soon as the law goes into effect, these angry backcountry men start to rebel against it. The Washington administration starts to send out basically like little federal employees out to the backcountry, quote unquote. And I'm talking backcountry meaning like present day Pittsburgh. It's Western Pennsylvania. He starts sending in people, tax collectors, to start imposing this tax on the folks living out in these regions. They are not well received. So between 1791 and 1794, there's minor skirmishes that continue to happen. In one such instance, there's a tax collector riding into town. Men in the region dress up as women and come out to greet this man, and they surround him on horseback, pull him off of the horseback, and they tar and feather him. And
so tarring and feathering to our modern ears, it sounds very funny, right?
And it sounds almost, it sounds comedic.
It's very Bugs Bunny.
Cartoonish. Yeah.
But yeah, it's very Bugs Bunny. It's like, ha ha.
It is I can't imagine more pain. I mean, pouring hot tar on somebody will most likely kill them. I think it usually resulted in death because you're talking third degree burns all over the body with a hot, sticky substance
right.
that melts your skin off.
They do a really good job in the John Adams miniseries showing tar and feathering.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I would just suggest to listeners, if you want to see a pretty good depiction of what this probably looked like, look at that John Adams miniseries. That's the one with Paul Giamatti.
Yes, that's right. So
yeah.
I do remember seeing that. And so tarring and feathering, it sounds sort of comical, like you said, to the modern ear, but it is serious, nasty torture.
It's death.
It's death.
Right?
And so they're tarring and feathering these federal tax collectors who come into the region. Here and there, they would destroy houses and barns. They would set fire to houses and barns of anybody who was collecting taxes and anybody who was cooperating with the tax collecting effort. So if you had people who were your neighbors who were submitting to these federal taxes, they would go burn their houses down for complying.
Yeah.
So this new federal government is trying to exercise some form of power, trying to consolidate the region, and you have outright rebellion. And it's sort of this carried over spirit of the revolution of wanting to just shirk any sort of power over people, I think. And I mean, you have this still this strong sense of wanting to be independent, not wanting to owe money, not wanting to be, and it sounds childish, right? But not wanting to be told what to do, not wanting anybody right. or anything or any government or power or centralized force to exert control over the lives of a community. And so they're fighting it. And this is the interesting moment where the Washington administration has a choice. I mean, do they allow this rebellion to take place and allow, you know, somewhat of a revolution to continue, or do they squash it? And they right. squash it. So,
well, I mean, it's the interesting thing, I think, is Shay's Rebellion is kind of, you look at it, there's not a lot of death or destruction. There's some destruction involved in it. But the Whiskey Rebellion seems like something much worse, right?
Oh, it's way worse because it happens, it slowly boils, right? 1791 is when the excise tax is passed. It's not until 1794 that official rebellion is broken out. And Washington, the administration, is faced with this hardline decision. And they have to resort to violence because there's a continued resistance. And this continued resistance finally convinces Washington that he needs to assemble an army and act. And
a big army.
So he assembles an army of 13,000 militiamen. This
wow.
is the same size of the Continental Army that defeated the British during the Revolution. The same size army, 13,000 volunteers and militiamen. And so there's a minimum of violence, right? Because if you see that number of troops, and Washington leads the troops, which is a beautiful painting, right? And that's the painting that we all see in our history book
yep.
of him commanding the troops, because we don't see that. There aren't any presidents who lead troops into battle, right? Washington is the one.
He's it.
And so yeah, we have lots of presidents who served in the military, but he is the only president who leads troops into battle as president.
As commander in chief.
That's right.
Right.
And he leads
the army. No bone spurs there.
No bone spurs. So he takes this moment as like, we're not going to take this. We're going to be a country by gosh, you know, like this is this really important moment in the country because it's a do or die situation. We came so close at so many moments in the 1790s to not being the United States. And this is one of those pivotal moments where there was a major decision made that saved the country in a sense. And
right.
I get so pumped about it, but it's just like this it blows your mind to think about what a tumultuous situation they were in.
Right. Well, I think the interesting thing for me is that Washington, I mean, this really is when the myth of Washington really starts to grow, right? Is that he comes in with this massive army and he could have mowed these men down.
Yeah, he doesn't. They restore peace without much violence. And right. That's also a cool moment. He's assembled this massive militia and he goes in and he could, you're right, he could completely destroy people and he doesn't. I mean, he leads troops with the intention of bringing order and he doesn't want it to be a chaotic situation. And it leads to more discussion of his heroism in a sense, because he becomes this mythological presence created by this of him coming in and restoring order with minimal chaos. And, right. And that's kind of where I think a lot of reverence is built up, even amongst some, you know, of the anti-federalists. There's a reverence for Washington, even amongst the crazy political strife and battles that take place, particularly amongst like Jefferson and Hamilton, right? I mean, they really don't like each other, but there's still,
but they both like him.
There's a reverence, right? There's a reverence right. for George Washington. And
well, I mean, you have these parades when he's inaugurated president, and then when he, you know, making this trip to take the oath of office and stuff. And people are just out everywhere. People love George Washington. So I wanted to go back to you talking about the men dressed as women, because I think this is part of something else that a lot of people don't really know goes on. And as historians, we joke about certain things because it's something we see all the time. So one of the jokes we make in history is if women start protesting food issues, let me wait just a minute till he gets done. So if women start protesting food issues, you know it's about to get real.
Right. And that happens during the Civil War.
Civil War. It happens right before the French Revolution. I mean, when you have bread riots, food riots, yeah, something exactly. like that, it's usually women leading them. And there's, you know, it's fairly obvious in the end of the 18th, the beginning of the 19th century, why that may be, because they're the ones who are kind of responsible at home for food. So these men are dressed as women. And it's part of this bigger regulator movement. And I don't think we talk enough about regulator movements when we teach U.S. history, because it's so critical. I mean, the regulator movements and even regulator movements that are explicitly led by women, and a lot of them are, were so critical in the early days of the revolution. Right.
Right. I mean, what do you want to talk about specifically?
Well, I mean, it's so you talked about how they would like destroy the house and property of people who were cooperating with the whiskey tax. I mean, the regulator movements, these women would go around and be like, hey, Hillary, you're drinking tea out of kind of English imported China. What are you doing?
Well, it's, right? Yeah, I mean, it's led by civilians. And in a way, it kind of goes back to our discussion about witches, where right. there was like civilians policing other civilians, right? I mean, it's kind of like neighbors spying on each other in a way.
Right. But this is how society operated, right? This is really how order was kept. If somebody was viewed as violating norms, societal norms, communal norms or laws, the regulator movements could really kind of bring them back in line. And Shays and his followers definitely saw themselves as part of the regulator movement. They were like, this is perfectly legitimate what we're doing. And I think the Whiskey Rebellion protesters felt the same way, is that they, you know, the government has gone too far.
Well, and they had gotten away with it so many times. And I don't mean they got away with it in the sense that it was something terribly wrong, but it's just like it was all in the spirit of the era. There were multiple moments during this era where people were fighting back against government excess. And some things were called revolution and others were called rebellion. And there's a fine line there, right? We don't call it the revolution, the whiskey revolution. We call it the rebellion, right? And it's just about how we perceive it as historians.
Or insurrection.
How we discussed it, or insurrection, right? And I mean, whereas there are different moments, right? Like the Tea Party or something. I mean, that's a rebellion, but we consider it an act of revolution. And so you have to think about people living in that moment and how they perceive their own actions. And I don't think that they saw themselves as being rebels or causing a major problem, but they just saw themselves acting within the spirit of the moment. Like, well, this is just what we're doing. This is the revolutionary spirit. We're encapsulating the feelings of an era and the way that we, you know, we're just doing what we've been doing for the last 10, 15 years, right? We've been fighting up against government excess. And at a certain point, though, they have to, the newly formed federal government has to say, enough. Revolution is over. We're moving into a new era of building government, a new government. And a lot of people are like, eh, it's not that new. And that kind of circles back to what you first started talking about is it really a revolution or is it more of a conservative movement, right? I mean, and I think that you just still have people who are caught up in that revolutionary spirit and it has to come to an end at a certain point because they can't keep having these acts of revolution without being answered to.
Right. Well, I mean, ultimately the sovereignty of the government has to be recognized for the state to kind of move on and do what it needs to do, right? Yeah. They can't keep rehashing this. I mean, the interesting thing is this, the whiskey tax ends up getting repealed ultimately though, right?
Right. And it, because it was
by whom?
Disproportionately affecting by Jefferson.
Surprise, right? Here we go. Here's the guy who said the Shaysites were doing something that was good. Here he comes and he says, you know, the whiskey tax is not right.
Because it's taxing people who shouldn't be being taxed. I mean, because the thing with the whiskey tax too, not to get too technical about the math of it or whatever, but it was disproportionately affecting small distillers.
Right.
And backcountry distillers, because folks who were producing it in mass production, I think they were taxed like 9 cents. And people who were producing it in smaller batches, they were producing much smaller amounts, but at 6 cents. And so it was costing them a lot more money for their small batches than like, say, one large batch that went out. So it was disproportionately affecting people who had the least amount of money to give. And I think Jefferson was always sympathetic to those backcountry, so to speak, people.
Right. I mean, so the interesting thing is, under the old Articles of Confederation, the federal government couldn't have done this.
No.
They couldn't have levied these taxes, right?
Absolutely. And so it's the first moment, really, where they are starting to levy taxes under Hamilton's new fiscal plan, which was highly controversial. And people aren't happy with it. People aren't happy with the new Constitution. Not everybody's for it. And so this is one of those moments where we just see people going, we're not pumped about this. And we're going to continue rebelling and you know, having these moments of revolution to try to say this isn't what we want. And eventually, again, it just, they have to say enough. No, we are doing this. This is the country. It's expensive to be on your own. We need the money. But, you know, because of these nascent political parties that develop, the Anti-Federalists, Democratic Republicans, they come in and say, we're repealing this tax.
Right.
And it's,
well, I mean, but Hamilton also gets support of social reformers, right?
Yes. Oh, well, sure, because they think it's great.
It's a sin tax.
Of course, they're taxing alcohol. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Particularly hard alcohol, right? Yeah. They're like, we need to tax whiskey. I mean, I'd love to get more into a conversation about alcohol in the early Republic because, for those of you who think you've seen extreme drinking, eventually we'll do an episode where we talk about how much the average colonial American drank throughout the day, which is mind-numbing.
They were drunk all the time.
Yes, basically the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, they were all written by highly inebriated individuals. It's surprising they did anything.
Yes.
So any last comments on the rebellions here, the Whiskey Rebellion and Shays Rebellion?
Well, I think I'm excited by it. I'm excited by the era. I see so many parallels to problems that we have throughout history at different moments, right? So if you teach the survey courses in U.S. history and you're teaching about this in class, like, talking about these rebellions is so important for scaffolding the United States. So important for scaffolding, like, the spirit of the country, the culture, some of the problems that exist at that moment, and then again, and again, and again, and again. And so if you get a good foundational understanding of these rebellions and why they happened and why they're important, you can understand a lot about the history of this country just by exploring the 1790s, but by exploring these two moments, because they really do shape so much of the conflicts that continually occur in the decades and centuries to come.
Yeah. I mean, the urban-rural divide is still with us today, right? Politically, there's a huge difference between the two. Culturally, there seems to be a lot of animosity between the two regions.
We've never been this divided before.
But we have.
The 1790s, that was like the height of it, except of course the Civil War. But like
the Civil War, right?
Second to Civil War, I would say.
Yeah, when people say we've never been this divided, I'm like, well, first we had a Civil War, which is really divided.
We literally were divided.
750 million or 750,000 dead.
That's the highest.
Not million.
I think that's a high estimate.
I know that. I think it's a good estimate, though.
I'll roll with it.
It's definitely not 750 million. Let me make that clear.
Not that many. No.
750,000.
Not even Stalin accomplished that.
Right. Yeah. Whoa. But, I mean, yes, it's still there. Even today, you hear about it, right? I mean, culturally, think about where we think kind of moral correctness comes from. Does it come from the cities or the countryside? Most people, even if they don't want to say it, say, oh, the countryside's probably more morally upright than the city. And a lot of that kind of plays out in these rebellions. Well, thanks. I mean, we could talk for a long time about this. I'm just looking at my notes and like so many things I wanted to talk about with like all of both of these and like how they changed the conversation for the Constitution, but Hillary.
I think what we did today, though, is good because it lays the foundation for future episodes.
That's true. To kind of look
back on this and say, look, this is this foundational moment, and we can continue to come back to this. And we also laid out an agenda for discussing drunkenness. So, I mean,
which is awesome.
It's great.
Like, great. Well, thank you so much, Hillary. This has been a great conversation today. Join us every week for a brand new episode of An Incomplete History. If you like our show and you haven't rated or reviewed us on Apple Podcasts, please do so. You can follow us there, subscribe to the podcast, as well as Spotify or wherever you might find your podcast. Additionally, you can go to our website, anincompletehistory.com. There you can find more information as well as a place where you can submit comments and questions. We're definitely going to be doing a Q&A special edition at some point in the near future. Get your questions in. We'll try to address as many as we possibly can. That's it for today. My name's Jeff.
And I'm Hillary.
And thanks for tuning in to An Incomplete History.